Dan, Jeff, John, thank you. Thank you so much. Never get tired of hearing that. Sounds good. Two weeks ago, we observed the birthday of Martin Luther King here with a very moving presentation by Harvey Key and some wonderful music from our choir. I was glad to have the opportunity to sit out in the pews for part of that service while Harvey spoke, and instead of being up here, I find I need to do that now and then just to see what it looks like up here to you who are out there. And I want to revisit just one single piece of Dr. King's life this morning as a way of introducing this subject that I'm going to touch a lot of different bases on that line we heard about, "There is a road, no simple highway." One of the many what-ifs of American history is that of what if Martin Luther King had not chosen the road that he did, that being the road of ministry in the African-American church, out of which he emerged as the leader of the civil rights movement from the mid-1950s on through the 1960s until his death at age 39 in 1968. Perhaps another leader would have emerged. That's always one of those questions: do people create history, or do history create people? And it's some of both, obviously. Another leader would have emerged probably as the times were right for Dr. King's ministry and message and actions. We'll never really know, nor at this point do we need to, but I find the question intriguing nonetheless: what if he had chosen a different road? Because according to his biographers, the ministry was not Dr. King's first career choice. He grew up in the large shadow cast by his father, who was a very large man, the Reverend Martin Luther King Sr., who as the minister of Atlanta, Georgia's Ebenezer Baptist Church, was one of the most prominent and highly respected members of Atlanta's African-American community and was very well regarded by many whites in that still segregated city in the 1930s and 40s, 40s and 50s. And for all the love and the respect that he had for his father, young Martin also felt he needed to move out of his father's shadow and establish an identity of his own. And so initially he decided he didn't want to do the ministry and consider a career in law. But in the end, he did choose the study of religion, theology, thinking towards the ministry. That eventually took him up here to this area, to Boston University, where he eventually was awarded a PhD from there. So think of the position that he was in at that point. He's 26 years old. He has a doctorate from a prominent Northeastern university. The woman he had recently married, Coretta Scott, was pursuing a career in voice while attending the New England Conservatory of Music, also in Boston. Dr. King's roots were in the African-American South, but at this point in his life, like I said, he's 26 years old. He's been living in the North for 7 years. And in a way, he and his wife were both primed for careers in academia and the arts, albeit in a still largely racially segregated society. In other words, the career path, the career track, the career highway was there for him. Now, granted, for Dr. King, a career in academia would not have been a simple highway. It would have had its challenges and its mountains to climb, but it most likely would have been safer. It certainly would have been more protected than the road he chose. And in choose he did, chose to return to the South, take up the ministry. In the black church of that time, young Martin saw opportunities to work in and through that institution for the greater cause of racial equality. And I doubt at the outset even he saw where that choice and where that road would lead. Well, the song "Ripple" wasn't even written until after Dr. King's death, so he obviously never heard of it. I'm not sure how much he would have even related to it. It didn't strike me as exactly being the deadhead type. I wasn't really either, but I still like this song of theirs written by Robert Hunter. Like so many metaphorically rich songs or poems, this one can be heard and interpreted on any number of levels. And its line, "There is a road, no simple highway," is one that I take as a reference to the choices that we make that guide and direct the course of our lives. It has to do with maybe seeing a script for yourself that maybe you've written or maybe somebody else has written, just a kind of a prescribed script for yourself, and then deciding if that script, that highway, simple or not, is the one you really want to follow. Or do you choose another road instead? I appreciated Burns' reading this afternoon. It plays right into these words. You choose another road instead. A road, in Robert Frost's very well-known words, that is less traveled. And that was really the choice that Martin Luther King faced at age 26. And he opted for the road with all of its perils. It was a road that 13 years after that choice cost him his life at the age of 39. And yet we are a better nation for his having chosen that road. Well, this is a backdrop. I'm going to offer then a, what you call it, meditation on this very enigmatic song, which I said I've developed a certain fondness. And frankly, I'd never paid it a whole lot of attention until a few years ago when on one of my Bay Area trips, I had lunch with a gentleman named Dennis McNally. Dennis has written what I consider to be probably the best biography on Jack Kerouac that's out there. In addition to sharing this common interest, the other point of commonality that he and I discovered once we met up with each other is that his now deceased father was a Unitarian Universalist minister and served the UU Church over in Haverhill, Massachusetts, which is where Dennis grew up before eventually settling in San Francisco. And after writing this Kerouac biography, then for much of the 1980s and 90s, Mr. McNally was the publicist and the advanced man for the Grateful Dead. And he wrote a very good book about that experience, too, about the history of that group and its place in American culture. The book is titled, not unsurprisingly, if you know their songs, A Long Strange Trip. Well, when we met up then, I brought along my copy of his Grateful Dead book for him to sign. He did, and we began what has been a good friendship. After a few personal words from me, then Dennis wrote that line. There is a road, no simple highway, and then he signed his name. I don't know if he was trying to give me a specific message or if he just liked that passage. Maybe he wrote it in all the books that he signed, I don't know. But somehow I felt that thing was being directed towards me. I went back and looked at the song, picked up the whole line, which is, there is a road, no simple highway, between the dawn and the dark of night. Well, like I just said, I was never really a deadhead, although that was and is an okay thing for people to be. For all of my, it is, yeah. I'm sort of caught in age thing here. For all my interest in the Beat Generation, I never quite followed through to the hippie scene there. As I say, that's probably a factor of age. I was too young to be a Beat. I was 12 years old when On the Road was published, and I really felt like I was, by the time the hippie thing came along, I felt like I was a little too old for that. So I never quite made it into either camp. And until I had read Dennis McNally's book, I don't believe I could have named even five Grateful Dead songs. But as I'm saying, I found myself quite taken with this one. It's full of metaphors that seemed, in some cases, kind of double back on themselves. I would guess, kind of like Don McLean's American Pie, there's probably been master's theses written about what this song really means, which probably gives Robert Hunter a good laugh. He might even get a chuckle out of where I'm going to go with it, but go I will. In its broadest interpretation, I see the passage, as I've already hinted at, as a metaphor for the life journey. Birth and death, the dawn and dark of night. And the road and the highway, as I've already said, refer to the choices we're given after our personal dawn or morning has broken, and before we face the dark of each of our nights. We can make our own road, deliberately seeking purpose and intention and meaningful engagement with life that is all around us, or take the simple highway, maybe cruise along in a more unreflective kind of a manner, living in accordance with the general societal assumptions of one's day, and seeking to live up to whatever standards of success one's culture may dictate. As we also saw at the outset, it is usually those who choose the road over the simple highway, who change the course of history, and even the nature of history itself. To go back to the time and place where I opened for just a moment, Rosa Parks could have chosen the simple highway when she got on that bus in Birmingham, Alabama on the 1st of December of 1955. She could have acquiesced to the general societal assumptions of her day about the proper place of persons of color. But by the simple act of sitting near the front of the bus than she was quote-unquote supposed to, she opted instead for the hard road. And the road to racial equality in the nation ended up taking a decisive turn. As a result, that road is still ongoing. A very simple little act, choosing the road over the simple highway. Well, okay, I'm going to shift gears a little bit now to give these words, to the words of this song, yet another angle and bring them a little closer to home here. For I believe the reason that people seek out religious communities, especially ones like ours, are because they are looking for the road and not the simple highway. They're looking for a place of meaning and hope and human engagement, for a communion of people and ideals and values that expects and demands something of them and to which they can freely give of themselves. And in coming here, I believe they're looking for a place where they can choose with both joy and serious deliberation the road they wish to take rather than the prescribed highway. Founder of American Unitarianism, William Ellery Channing, said that the faith he was putting forth was for people who were not content with what he called a secondhand faith. In other words, one that had been prescribed and that they were expected to accept. That's the prescribed highway. And we are called then to offer and to be one such community. I don't want to be, and I am not, presumptuous or chauvinistic enough to say that there are not other faith communities outside of our communion who also encourage the searching and the seeking mind. I know there are when it comes to matters of religion and spirituality. It's just that my career is that of the Unitarian Universalist Ministry, and I'm speaking to a UU congregation. And so I'm going to pick up on a couple more lines from Hunter's song that I think demonstrate well the yin and the yang, or the dual truths, if you will, of how we approach the religious journey here. One says, that path is for your steps alone, while the other says, reach out your hand if your cup be empty. However at variance those two lines may seem at first, when you first look at them, we actually affirm both. Yes, we do believe that each person ultimately has to seek and find his or her own truth. But we do not wish to send you, and we don't send you on that search empty-handed or with an empty cup. Reach out your hand if you're feeling empty or confused or questioning. For there are other hands here that will join you on our common way. And then there's that line, if you should stand, then who's to guide you? If I knew the way, I would take you home. I believe contained within there is the implicit message of the covenant in which we share. We offer our guidance to one another in our homeward journeys of the mind and spirit, however sure or unsure we may be of the way itself. And while I know that my own words do not always glow with the gold of sunshine, gives me something to aim for, anyway. I, too, am someone on this road. Sometimes those words may sound more like a tune played on a harp unstrung than they do glowing with the gold of sunshine. But as I say, I, too, am someone on this road, seeking my own way to whatever home there may be. A minister, yes, but also a fellow traveler with you. So let me continue on, then, say a little bit about the road that keeps calling us. For indeed, it is no simple highway. I find for myself right now, and it may well be the case with you, there's much in life that I feel very good about, that I want to celebrate, that I find joy over. And yet right on the razor edge of that joy, our occasional feelings of frustration over the sheer human folly we human beings are so often prone to. There is still so much unfinished when it comes to our living in a sane, just, and peaceful land and world. And perhaps that will always be so. And yet, part of the road we choose is one of attempting to move what Theodore Parker called the moral arc of the universe, just a few more degrees towards a reconciled world. This is the nature of the road we choose, and not a simple highway that says, well, that's just the way things are, and we can't change it. In looking to travel a road where one's yes to life can still be said, even in the face of a number of no's, I really find myself turning more to poetry than to theology. It was back in the mid-1950s that Lawrence Ferlinghetti, who for my money, still at age 92, is America's premier living poet, he wrote a song, another part of my compendium of personal script, part of my compendium of personal scripture that I keep coming back to. First came out in 1958 in a collection of writings called A Coney Island of the Mind. It's whimsical and fun and sobering all at the same time. It speaks to what it means to travel that razor edge of finding joy in living while also being aware of so much that can be life less than joyful or life denying. The poem is called The World's a Beautiful Place. Give it a listen. The world is a beautiful place to be born into. If you don't mind happiness not always being so much fun, if you don't mind a touch of hell now and then just when everything is fine, because even in heaven they don't sing all the time. The world is a beautiful place to be born into if you don't mind some people dying some of the time, or maybe only starving some of the time, which isn't half so bad if it isn't you. Oh, the world is a beautiful place to be born into if you don't mind a few dead minds in the higher places, or a bomb or two now and then in your upturned faces, or other such improprieties as our name brand society is prey to, with its men of distinction and its men of extinction, and its various segregations and congressional investigations and other constipations that our full flesh is heir to. Yes, the world is the best place of all for such things as making the fun seem, and making the love seem, and making the sad seem, and singing low songs and having inspirations, and walking around looking at everything and smelling flowers, and goosing statues, and kissing people and making babies and wearing pants and waving hats and dancing, and going swimming in rivers on picnics in the middle of the summer, and just generally living it up. Yes, but then, right in the middle of it, comes the smiling mortician. We're called to be joyously alive in the face of the various deaths that also confront us. And that's not always an easy road to take, but it still beats the simple highway. The life stance that Ferlinghetti is calling for here has a parallel in the late Reverend Forrest Church's definition of religion. Prior to his untimely death, about a year ago, Forrest was one of the most prolific thinkers and writers within our Unitarian Universalist movement in the late 20th and into the early 21st century. His most oft-quoted passage, probably his most oft-quoted passage, is the one that says, "Religion is our human response to the dual reality of being alive and knowing that we will die." Reverend Church would have been the first to admit that his words don't have the same quite poetic ring and zing to them as do Ferlinghetti's, but he's saying as a theologian and a minister what Lawrence is saying as a poet, that the world is indeed a beautiful place to be born into, even as we also know that yes, and right in the middle of it comes the smiling mortician. What kind of roads do we choose in that time then that we have to do that between those times? I'm going to ask you to indulge me in a little Ferlinghetti story here before I leave him. Back when I was working on that Beat Face of God book I got out some time back, I was able actually to arrange to have an interview with him at the office, which he still keeps, by the way, at San Francisco City Lights bookstore. which he founded in 1952. Turned out the day before our scheduled meetup, it was in the summer, I attended a reading he gave at a bookstore in Berkeley, California, while doing one of my sojourns at the Pacific School of Religion. Mr. Ferlinghetti had just then published another volume of poetry, and he was doing some readings from it. Some of the poems were very poignant. Others were rather pungent and biting. I'd met him on one other occasion, and so I was at this reading. I only spoke to him very briefly. I knew a lot of other people there, and I figured, well, I'll keep this short. I'm supposed to be seeing him the next day. Well, it's too long of a story to tell, but due to a really boneheaded blunder on my part, having to do with locking the keys to the rental car I had in the trunk of that car, I got to the bookstore about an hour or so after I was supposed to be there. When I finally did arrive, I found that Lawrence had left, but he'd also left me a very nice note saying he was sorry we didn't get a chance to talk, and he had to go home because he felt a cold coming on, and he was wanting to rest up so he would feel well enough to go to a San Francisco Giants baseball game that evening. And as bad as I felt about blowing the meeting, there was something that sounded right and good to me about a man who came one night give a very beautiful and somewhat caustic poetry reading about our country's current state of affairs, and then go to a Major League Baseball game the next night. I have to say, that is my kind of poet. Well, I want to hold up just one more verse from Hunter Ann Garcia's Ripple as I finish up for today. Picks up on a line I cited earlier. Reach out your hand if your cup be empty. If your cup is full, may it be again. Let it be known there is a fountain that was not made by the hand of man. Maybe if Hunter were writing the song today, he'd say the fountain is not made by human hands. It's the same idea. Sometimes you're going to come in here with your cup running close to empty. Other times it will be so full, you'll come here with plenty to share with others. Maybe other times it'll be half full, half empty, depending upon how you choose to view it. But whatever the state of your cup, I do believe that ultimately we do draw from a fountain not entirely made by human hands. This fountain is the ultimate source of all life that is both within each of us and beyond each of us. However we each envision and name that source or ground of all life, the blessed and holy spirit of life about which we sing every Sunday, we come here to partake of it so that we may then walk well on our chosen roads. The ones we walk as individuals and the ones we walk as part of this covenanted religious community. Sometimes I think we Unitarian Universalists have spent more time than we need to contending over what the right and proper name of this fountain should be, sometimes to the point that we never actually get around to drinking from it. I think, though, we have a rich and deep fountain here to refresh and nurture each of us on our life's journeys. I hope we can each and all partake of it well. As for its precise name, well, once again, I'm with Robert Hunter. I don't know. Don't really care. Let there be songs to fill the air. Let's sing together number 345. With joy we claim the growing light.